UK Wine Show, show number 303. Rathvini Vineyards with Mark Driver. Hello and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with Mark Driver from Rathvini Vineyards in England. Mark is in the process of planting up what will become the UK's largest winery in about 3 or 4 years' time. We're going to be talking to Mark about his goals, his ambitions, and the process he underwent to get ready to plant such a big vineyard. I've been pretty busy in the office this week, nothing too exciting. I haven't been to any trade tastings or anything like that. Did pop down to southern England, down in the New Forest, last Saturday, and recorded a show with Tim on a vineyard that's only 3/4 acre and inside a closed wall. And we talked to him about the effects of having walls around your garden, as well as some of the aspects about orientation that is so important in various parts of the UK. But this week, we're just going to be talking to Mark, as I said. I'm going to start the show off pretty straightforward. We're going to get straight into the show, and we're going to start off with our mystery wine grape variety. As usual, you've got to try and work out what you think the mystery grape variety is. I'm going to give you a clue now, clue before the interview, and then the answer at the end of the show. So our mystery French white grape variety is generally more of a workhorse grape than a star. It's a member of the expansive family of vines that have been shown, according to DNA analysis, to be an offspring of Pinot Noir and the obscure white grape planted in Burgundy in the medieval times, Gouyer Blanc. It has a roundness of flavour with occasionally an apparent sweetness as a result of its relatively low acidity. The grape looks pretty similar to Chardonnay, so for many years no distinction was made between them, but is less full-bodied than its more common sibling and tends to be drunk young. However, with low yields, it's possible to barrel age with success. In France, this grape tends to be used mostly in Alsace and often blended with Auxerrois. But in Germany, where it's known as Westburgunder, it's especially fond with growers looking for food-friendly wines. Here, it seems to show off more of its diversity of personality. It can be full and rich in Baden and in Pfalz, but relatively delicate along the Nere and Mosel-Sarrua area. Have we think about that? I'll give you the next clue in the mystery grape variety after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Cooler weather, a late harvest, and an Indian summer should please wine connoisseurs this year, according to the New Zealand Wine Growers Association. New Zealand had a fantastic April and promises to deliver very good quality wine once it hits the shelf. The latest wine harvest has been a long time coming, and it's unclear what volumes will be, but precise figures should be known in about 6 weeks' time. Philip Gregan, head of the New Zealand Wine Growers Association, said the smaller harvest contrasts to the wine oversupply of the last 3 to 4 years, which warped supply and demand and could result in the end of super low prices.
I do hope to see a reduction in the amount of cheap Sauvignon Blanc hitting the stores. I must admit, I've tried a few of these entry-level Sauvies from New Zealand, and I must admit, they are pretty average. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, Hollywood heartthrob Brad Pitt is to star in the film of Benjamin Wallace's Billionaire's Vinegar. The story tells of how in 1985, at an auction by Christie's of London, a 1787 Chateau Lafite, unearthed in a Paris cellar and supposedly owned by Thomas Jefferson, went for $156,000 to a member of the Forbes family. The discoverer of the bottle was Hardy Rodenstock, a pop band manager turned wine collector, with a knack for finding extremely old and exquisite wines. But rumours about the bottle soon arose. Why wouldn't Rodenstock reveal the exact location where it had been found? Was it part of a smuggled Nazi hoard, or did his reticence conceal an even darker secret? Pursuing the story from London to Zurich to Munich and beyond, Benjamin Wallace offers a mesmerising history of wine and of Jefferson's wine-soaked days in France. That's the blurb from the film, but the court case surrounding the counterfeit Jefferson bottles continues, and billionaire William Koch has asked a US appeals court to revive the lawsuit against Christie's for assisting the sale of the fake 1787 Lafite bottles. He had bought them from Hardy Rodenstock for around $500,000.
The book is a brilliant true life detective story and should make a great movie, especially with Brad Pitt in it. He's a great actor. One to watch for. The date is still to be announced, but is due to be out sometime this year, so I'm going to be in the queue ready to watch that one. What's the last story, Jane?
Finally this week, Pancho Campo, the first Spanish master of wine, has resigned. It follows last year's controversy around the organisation of wine tastings in Spain, where allegedly Campo had been charging Spanish wineries for access to Jay Miller, the correspondent for Robert Parker's Wine Advocate. Of course, to become an MW, or Master of Wine, is considered the pinnacle of any wine professional's career, as it's the hardest educational standard in the wine world. Only a few hundred have passed and many have failed. An investigation has been completed by the Institute and they were due to consider this report this week. However, the following statement from Campo was released. Pancho Campo has today informed the Institute that in light of his move into sports and music events and away from wine, he has decided to resign his membership of the Institute of Masters of Wine, effective immediately. According to Decanter.com, the report recommended that Campo, who became the first Spanish MW in 2008, should be suspended from the Institute for a period of 2 to 3 years. That's all from me, but don't forget to check out these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. This is both sad and disappointing. I know Pancho has put on a brave face about this, but I met Pancho just after he'd been awarded his MW, and he was so proud of the achievement. It must be a bitter pill to have to hand it back in. In fact, we have interviews with Pancho shortly after he received his Master of Wines, if you want to listen to the archives of the UK Wine Show. But I suspect what's happened is, after the Institute of Master of Wines received a report on what was going on, their policy is to either release the report and make it public, or, if the person resigns, not to release the report. I suspect this is something that Pancho did not want to happen, and so he's resigned. The blog post that brought all this to the head by Jim, if you want to read it, is called Campogate, No Pay, No Jay. You just need to Google that, Campogate, No Pay, No Jay, and it'll come up there. In a string of emails, the most damning one seems to come from Pancho, and I'm going to read you what he says in the letter. Dear Adele, she's from Venus de Madrid, the winery that says they weren't willing to pay for Jay Miller to come and visit their winery. Anyway, this is a unique opportunity for Venus de Madrid, seeing as how this DO is not in Parker's plans to be visited in either 2012 or 2013. Private visits off the set agenda, as that would be, rarely take place, and not for the price below 40,000 euros. The fact that Jay has agreed to stay two more nights and for half the usual price is a miracle and the opportunity that Madrid will find it difficult to have again. We close our diary next Wednesday. I hope they reconsider, especially considering how difficult the market is for Spain, and a little push like this can help a lot, Pancho. As I said, it's a shame that the wine industry has lost Pancho, and in another industry this would not have been at all important. But the Wine Advocate's owner, Robert Parker, makes a big thing about being independent. And he also makes a big thing about paying for all his trips. And if this was true, which it does look like it is a massive slur on him and his magazine. Just to make it clear though, while Pancho appears to have fallen on his sword, as yet there is no evidence that Jay Miller knew anything or that there was a cover-up by the Wine Advocate. Although Jay Miller did resign shortly after the story came free. But this is a mere coincidence and unrelated, according to Pancho and Robert Parker. So, nothing to see here. Move along. It's all above board. Don't worry about it. Maybe. Maybe not. Does look like a lot of smoke, as they say. All right, let's finish up with the news now and move on to the spotlight. Now, this week's spotlight is a wee bit of a weird one. It's not really a spotlight. It's more of a commentary that I'd like to make. There's been a lot in the press about Anita Alvarez-Peters. She's the head wine buyer for Costco. She was quoted as comparing wine to toilet paper. Well, you can imagine that has put some expensive nosers out of joint. After all, how could a piece of toilet paper compare to the metaphor for life that is wine? But there's more than one way to look at this. If you remove the passion for wine that we all have, and look at it under the hard fluorescent light of a mega supermarket chain, then the product to people who don't have any passion is simply a unit, and in a unit of this or a unit of that, it doesn't really matter. Under these sort of conditions, wine can look the same as any other product, whether it be toilet paper or oranges. What most people, I think, feel disappointed about is that the head of wine buying could lack a personal engagement or a passion for the product. But Costco is a big business in the US. In fact, they're the biggest wine retailer in the US. Ultimately, as long as this PR mistake doesn't reduce sales, or if it does, her next role could be looking after toilet paper. I would like to say, though, that I do think the similarity does go a bit deeper. I would like to contend that perhaps it isn't the lack of passion for wine that Anita Alveza Peters suffers from, but it's perhaps her passion for toilet paper. Maybe she really likes the square stuff. I know people, and I'm sure you do, who if you give them half a chance would love to talk for ages on their ablutions. Here, toilet paper is the cherry on top, the bit that you feel like you're in control of. After all, isn't it the cool touch of something soft that gives you relief after a hot curry? But I actually think the wine industry is being a bit of a disservice to the people who make toilet paper. I remember at university meeting forestry engineers, the viticulturalists of toilet paper. They were some great, fun, outdoorsy types who love spending time in forests of trees. But even a pine forest grown for making these rolls of relief can be a peaceful place for a bike or a walk. No matter what the natural guys say, wine needs a winemaker. And our rolls of relief producers of paper are the paper mills. These are large, sometimes massive industrial factories, as big and ugly as places can be. Tourism is not a key part of their business at all, unlike wineries. But they make a range of paper products, from the bottom, pardon the pun, of toilet paper, to the heights of 120 gram Concur bamboo paper, the Toyota Prius of paper. While I don't know any paper makers, I can't comment on their passion, I do know printers and designers who are very picky about the types of paper they use. Which answers the important question of passion. It is possible for a group of nuts to get very passionate about paper. And there are those who like to talk about the importance of one, two, heaven forbid, three-ply textured toilet rolls. They're just as disappointed, in fact probably more so, to hear of a tear in the tissue as we are of a corked wine. And I suspect perhaps more when you consider the implications. While it may be unfair to compare all wine in the same category as paper's most embarrassing subject, loo paper, to complain about Anna Alveza Peters' comments, while an easy and almost automatic response, it does a disservice to those who work in the industry of making paper. And I hope it's because of this that Evita made her comments. I like to look on the bright side, and I hope she's taking a more holistic point of view of the paper industry rather than comparing a top wine to a piece of dunny paper. Bit of a food for thought, maybe not quite what most people think, but I do think there's a lot of passion in the paper industry. And if toilet paper is your sort of 3 quid bottle of wine, you do get top-end papers, so I think we should be just a bit careful about it. I don't think it's such a gaff as people make out. But if you're a wine snob, I can imagine you're getting really worked up about it. Anyway, let's move off from toilet paper to wine. And this week's mystery wine was a wine that, as I said earlier, is more of a workhorse grape. Perhaps it's more of a toilet paper grape than perhaps a Pinot Noir or Chardonnay. I'm being a bit of a disservice here. But it is quite a nice grape. And in fact, when I was in Baden, we tasted a few of them. You may recall we spoke to a few people in Baden about various grape varieties. And this is one of the grape varieties we spoke about. I am after the French name of this wine, the one that we use in England. As I said, Vusburgunder, it's what it's known in Austria, where it excels to make almond-scented dry wines and also amazing super-rich botrytized Trockenbeeren Auslese. The ripest Vusburgunder tends to oak age and is often blended with other grape varieties, particularly Chardonnay. In Italy, the name is again different. I'm not going to give it to you because it would give away the game. And it's widely grown, actually more so than in its homeland of France. It seems particularly happy to grow in Collio and Isonzo in Friuli in the north of the country, where it produces interesting racy whites, both oat and oat, with good body and flavour. Generally, though, the Italians vinify as a slightly spritzy, high-acid wine for drinking young and for Spumanti in Lombarda. Elsewhere, it is found all over Eastern Europe, including Slovenia and Croatia. The New World has a little too, with British Columbia and the west of Canada making some of the most noteworthy. Although, in Latin America, what is known as our mystery grape variety is actually Chenin Blanc. Likewise in California, particularly in Monterey, older plantings of what is thought to have been our mystery variety turned out to be the Muscatel grape, Melon de Begunia. It's also grown in the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary. If we think about it, I think the big clue is if you remember from our interviews in Baden, the Vesburgunder, if you remember what the translation of Vesburgunder is, you'll have got it. If not, it's a bit of a toughie. But anyway, I'll give you the answer after the interview, which is coming up next with Mark Driver. We're going to be talking to Mark about Rathvini, setting up Rathvini, and the process that you need to go through to set up such a large vineyard. Let's have a listen to what Mark has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Mark Driver at Rathvinny Vineyards in... Oh, what's the name of the town?
Alfriston.
Alfriston,
yeah. Alfriston, East Sussex.
Alfriston. It's got a nice wee noddy trains or something like that on the way in. There's a big kiddies park on the way in.
There is. There's an old amusement place up on just off the A27 called Drusilla's.
Excellent. We're not here to talk about them, though. We're here to talk about Rathvinny. A wee while ago, I spoke to Richard Evan Thomas, and he was talking about how you guys are setting up the vineyard, but you're the man behind the business. Mervyn King was quoted just recently saying that people enter the financial services industry to leave the financial services industry with a big wad of cash. You were in the financial services industry. Now you're setting up a vineyard. It sounds like he was right. Is that a fair comment?
Well, not necessarily for myself. I really enjoyed my time working in the city. I enjoyed my job. I was very lucky to work in London and in Hong Kong. I then moved into running a fund with a friend of mine, and we set up a successful fund management business, which we ran for just under 10 years. But you know, after 25 years in the city, you either become too old for it, or you find that you want to do other things. You have other interests and you want to pursue, and that was really the case for myself.
Okay, and I presume wine's always been a passion. That's what it says on your CV on the web.
Yes, it has. I did various wine courses in the mid-80s, which I really enjoyed. Learned a lot about wine. Grew really my interest in wine and my knowledge about wine. And then when I was in Hong Kong, we went down to New Zealand, and we spent a long three-week trip driving around New Zealand. And that's really when the whole idea of possibly opening up a vineyard and owning our own vineyard really started. So that was in 1990. We've had lots of children in between times, and that didn't really fit with our plans, really. So that's when I stopped work in the end of 2009. The whole idea really sort of started again.
Okay. Well, you can hear the cars in the background. There's quite a few of them. There is a working vineyard now. You're planting up today.
Yes. Yeah, we started planting 2 days ago. So we're now in our third day of planting. We planted about 24,000 vines in the first 2 days. We've planted a mixture of Riesling, some Pinot Meunier, and we're now on to Pinot Noir. So we've been planting Pinot Noir all yesterday, and they'll be running Pinot Noir pretty much all today as well. So we've got about 25,000 plants to go in of Pinot Noir. And then we move on to the Chardonnay, probably on Thursday and Friday.
Before we get to where you are now, so you got your passion for owning vineyard in New Zealand, quite a good place to get a passion for owning a vineyard. Why did you decide to go to England instead of maybe buying, you know, Tony Lathwaite, a very famous man in the UK, just bought his third vineyard in Bordeaux? You could have just gone into France and done the same thing. Why England?
Yeah, it's good. It's a very good question. I've still got very young children who are relatively young children who are still at school age. I didn't really want to uproot them and move them overseas. And also, I looked at what's happening in England and the English wine market and got quite excited. I think that we are now with, one, the climate change, which is affecting our weather. You can see that we're sitting outside here. It's only the end of March. You know, the weather has improved in England. We've had a marked increase in average annual temperatures. We're now getting decent enough weather when we can really ripen our grapes to a level where we can make some decent wines, particularly our sparkling wine, and that's what we're aiming to produce. I think the other factor that got me really excited is, from a business perspective, England is a fantastic place to start producing your local wines. There is a trend and a movement towards locally produced, locally sourced food and drink in England. In a way, we're going to be fulfilling that local demand. We're now producing some of the best sparkling wine in the world. We've got a good fair wind behind us, I think.
What was your journey? So you decided, you bought the land about 18 months ago. So how did you start? Did you just hire Savills, for example, and say, find me some agricultural land? Or did you get some consultants in, or how, you know, what, very briefly, how did, what yeah, was the steps that you took yeah. to get to where
well,
you are?
In the summer of 2009, we decided that we were going to stop at the end of that year. So I knew, you know, that I what I then started working out what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to invest in some land, and I was looking at viticulture. So yes, I spoke to three different agents in London.
Who were they?
Land agents. Well, Knight Frank, Savills, and Stratton Parker, and they were looking for land. In fact, only one of them followed up really and was conscientious, and that was Stratton Parker, so give them a bit of a plug. But
yeah,
they went out and you know, they put a lot of different options in front of us. We were ideally looking for something around 250 acres, and the brief was that it's got to be on a slope, south facing, with free draining soils.
Mm-hmm.
That was the brief that went out. And I preferably wanted something in southern England, and to be honest, I really wanted something on the Downs, on the South Downs. So we looked at a few places, but they didn't really have the agricultural buildings. It's quite difficult to build agricultural buildings in the UK. And planning permission is actually quite difficult.
Okay.
So that's been quite a journey for us. So the first one we looked at, which was a really lovely piece of land in Hampshire, unfortunately, we had to decline because they didn't have enough space. They didn't have enough buildings. And then this piece of land came up for sale late summer 2010. And we were in Spain at the time, actually on holiday, and the agent called me and said, "I think I found the perfect piece of land for you, Mark." So I looked on Google Earth, and sure enough, it's just fantastic. It is simply the most ideal spot. It's the perfect spot. We have 600 acres of south-facing slopes, which literally run from the lower slopes go run down to 20 meters above sea level, and then we run up to right at the top about 110 meters. So mm-hmm. we've got that sort of slope, and it runs for about 2.5 kilometers along a river or dry river bed called Cradle Valley, and it's, as I said, all south facing. It's on a decent slope, but it's not too steep, and it's good agricultural land. It's been a good production of cereals and cereal crops and arable crops over the years.
You found the land. When did you enroll in Plumpton?
That was...
you're doing a winemaking course at Plumpton.
That's correct, yes. I'm doing what's called a foundation degree in wine production. So it's the beginning of the BSc. I've decided I'm not going to do my full BSc the third year. I'm just going to do the first two. And I was looking on the internet for my daughter for a course for university, and I found that you could study viticulture in England. I thought, well, viticulture in England, this is brilliant. So I phoned them up, and I went down to Plumpton College and checked it out, and it's just a fantastic course. It was just perfect for what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Because although I had, you know, I've drunk an awful lot of wine, and I love my wine, I didn't know enough about it really to be competent to be able to really help and direct people who I knew I'd have to employ to really the experts to employ to run them.
It's more about asking the right questions, isn't it?
Exactly. It's having that knowledge, that base knowledge, that you can exactly that, ask the right questions. So literally I put in my application the day before the deadline, and I think it's something like 17th of January or something in 2010. So I then started in the late September of that year. So I'm now in my second year at Plumpton. And the first year is brilliant because it's all about viticulture. So you spend your first year learning about, you know, how to plant, where to plant, soils, botany, and you go through an extensive and very intensive chemistry module, which you have to do, it's compulsory. So you go back to school and you learn all your proper chemistry again,
yeah,
which is quite amusing after about 30 years, you know, not studying chemistry. And that's really to set you up for the next year, because in the second year, you're really learning about winemaking. So it's perfect for me. So I was able to learn all about the viti, which I needed for the planting and the buying of our vines, the land. We had to do projects on the land. And you really get, you're in the vineyard in the first year, one day a week. So you're picking, Then you're pruning, you're putting in fencing posts, you're putting in trellising. It's very hands-on, and it's an ideal course.
Excellent. And you have tied yourself in with Plumpton, haven't you? Because I've read somewhere that you've bought a new building for them or something like that.
Yeah, not single-handedly. I've donated some money, or we donated some money to help build what's going to be the Wine Research Centre at Plumpton. So it's going to be called the Rathfinney Wine Research Centre. And it's my belief that in any good wine growing area, there's always a really good university behind it. Mm-hmm. And that raises all the skill levels. And that's what's happened with Plumpton. You know, if you think back 20 years ago, English wine industry was really making ghastly wine.
Yep.
It was dreadful.
Yeah, some of it's still pretty bad.
There's some really good stuff. A lot of it's very, very good. But then that's the same with any wine-growing region in any part of the world. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it was pretty ghastly. Now, you know, two things have happened. One is we've had climate change, and the improvement in the average temperatures has meant that our growing degree days are now comparable with parts of northern France and even parts of New Zealand. So, you know, we've got the temperatures now where we can ripen the grapes. What we didn't have is we didn't have the skill levels.
Yeah.
So we were keen to really put some money into research at Plumpton to make sure that they were going to be able to take that on. Because there's a hell of a lot of research done, but it's all done in warm climates. There's very little done in cool climates. You know, what grape varieties and what clones are really going to work well here? What techniques you can use to improve the quality of your wine, not just your sparkling wine, which we're very good at, but also your still wine.
Yep.
So that's the sort of thing that we were very keen to do and to invest in. And if you look around the world, you know, obviously there's France, you've got Reims, and you've got Bordeaux, which have got good research-based universities mm-hmm. for wine. In Australia, you've obviously got Adelaide, you've got...
Roseworthy.
You've got, you know, if you go to California, you've got obviously UC Davis, you know, which probably is the premier research university for wine in the world. And I was very keen to put some money into Plumpton so that we can get the research out of Plumpton to really look at the cool climate vineyards.
When did you make a decision on planting? So you've got the land, you started your Plumpton College 2010. When did you have to make a decision on planting it? And when did you buy the land? 2010?
Yeah, we bought the land in, we finally completed in October 2010.
So you'd been going to Plumpton for about a year by then?
No. I'd been going to Plumpton for a month. it was hilarious. I told
Chris Foss,
yeah, he's a lovely guy. He's, you know, he's the man behind the success of English wine. I told him that I bought some land, but I didn't really tell him the full details, and I think he was probably quite busy. It went in one ear and out the other. And there was this hilarious incident where he came into a lecture where we're all there, all our year group were all there, and he came in waving a sheet of paper saying, "You'll never believe this, but somebody's planting 400 acres of land in Alfriston, just down the road. I told you there'd be jobs, boys." And there were quite a few people around the room who sort of looked at me and go, is that you, pointing at me. I said, yeah. So then I had to tell him, and he said, "I didn't realize it was going to be that big." But no, it's been terrific, and it's been a great education.
Excellent. Okay, Mark, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you
very much. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Mark. Interesting and risky. We've got a second part of this interview coming up next week. If you remember last week, I made comments about large vineyards setting up, lots of capital cost. If you get complete loss, you need deep pockets. Before we finish up, the answer to the mystery grape variety this week was Pinot Blanc. Now, the French grape variety Pinot Blanc is generally more of a workhorse grape than a star. Pinot Blanc has a roundness of flavour with occasionally an apparent sweetness as a result of a relatively low acidity. The grape looks pretty similar to Chardonnay, so for many years no distinction was made between them. But Pinot Blanc is less full-bodied than its more common siblings and tends to be drunk younger. However, with low yields, it's possible to barrel age with success. Grown around the world, it makes a range of styles from almond-scented dry whites in Austria and high-acid wine for drinking young and for Spumante in Lombardia. and finish up with the quote this week. And the quote this week is from me. I was thinking about this half full, half empty glass when I was putting together the editorial. And I thought, you know what? I'm neither a half full bloke or a half empty sort of bloke. After all, a perfectly poured glass of wine is neither half full nor half empty. So half full is simply full. And I think that's a great way of looking at it. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.